Good morning, and may it please the court. Jenna Ellis, attorney registration number 44026, on behalf of appellant Stephen Baca, Esquire. This appeal arises from a default judgment of the court's September 18th, 2013 order awarding a judgment in excess of $91,000 in joint and several liability to both my client and his original client, Ashley Buss. At the initial onset of my argument, I'd like to clarify what I think has been a confused issue in this case. Not only has the record been very much muddled, but within the briefing in this case, I think that it's very important to clarify that there were two separate and distinct orders. The initial order was the June 25th order, which was defunct in the sense that it did not follow the prescriptions that are required by CRS 1317. 102 or 103, but then separate and distinct from that, the original defendant filed a motion for default judgment pro se on July 31st, and the September 18th order, which awarded over $91,000, was in response to that motion for default judgment.
I'm sorry if I can interrupt you, Ms. Ellis, because I'm confused. As you talk about a default judgment, I think there's the June 25th, 2013 order where the court says I'm going to award fees and costs, and I find the fees and costs reasonable. That's number one. Then we have a motion for entry of judgment by Mr. Crone that said please enter the judgment. So you have the order, but there's no judgment in the case. Asked for entry of judgment in a total amount of around $91,000. Is that what you're talking about?
That is. And
so where does the default judgment come from?
And so I'm referring to that same July 31st. That was actually on a domestic relations form, and he did file that. Mr. Crone filed that pro se. So
right.
The initial June 25th order by Judge Hyatt did refer back to the only two motions that were submitted to the court for the affidavit for attorney's fees. And those in total were only about $25,000. And so if you go back to the order that Judge Hyatt submitted on the last page of his June 25th order, it says that that the reasonableness of the fees and costs asserted, which I would submit to this court refers back to the only two motions for attorney's fees and costs that were ever filed in this case. And then finally, the court concludes that the court finds the fees and costs are reasonable, again, referring back to those two motions. Then, so that should have concluded what was then on appeal. And the initial appeal was filed in this case on August 1st of 2013, because that was the final judgment in this case, was the June 25th order.
Okay, so, now I need to interrupt you again. I just want to make sure I have the facts right. You talk about two motions. Ms. Halloran filed three different affidavits for fees. So are there two or three?
My reading of the record is that there were two.
All right, I'm looking at third affidavit of attorney's fees and cost of Susan Halloran.
And
so what am I missing?
So if the court is reading that there were three, those were still submitted prior to the June 25th order of the court.
Right.
So our argument essentially is that order of the June 25th order refers back only to, whether the court wants to say two or three, it only referred back to the costs and attorney's fees that were requested. This June 25th order is still deficient in the sense that it fails to address all specific factors of sections A through H of CRS 1317-102, however, and 103. And the September 18th order goes back to the motion that was filed pro se by Mr. Clifton Crone, and there was no evidence ever presented that would ever account for in excess of $91,000. So the September 18th order then became a part of this appeal, even though the appeal was initially filed on August 1st, going back to the June 25th. And I know that the timeline is a little bit confusing, but
Ms. Ellis, was it proper to file a notice of appeal in August if given that the June order did not include an amount of attorney's fees?
And Judge, we believe that it was. My client, Mr. Baca, initially was representing himself in that appeal. And so it was the understanding, at least my understanding of the case, was that it was the understanding at that time that the June 25th order was the final judgment in this case. The fact that the September 18th order and then the amended order, which was 20 minutes after the initial order, September 18th, there are two September 18th orders that essentially say the same thing. The amended order on September 18th simply adds a little bit more language. That order then came after the June 25th final judgment. So the fact that Mr. Crone submitted this pro se, he did not supply a certificate of service that was never served on ISIS, it was never served through an attorney, and it was never provided to my client or his initial client, Ashley Buss, in this case, for them to ever request a hearing on those issues, nor did the court, through Judge Hyatt, ever make any specific findings that are required by the Supreme Court in the Muniz case, nor by the language of the CRS statute.
I guess I'm still a little confused about the nature of the June 25th order. Could you explain how that was a final judgment if there's no amount, or are you saying there was an amount in that order?
That's correct. There was not an amount specified, but the language of that order referred back only to the final amount that was submitted in the affidavits. So while the court did not actually enter an amount, it can still be construed that the only affidavits and the only attorney's fees and costs that were submitted, which came out to about approximately $25,000, those were the only attorney's fees and costs at that point that were in question. So even if the initial appeal by Mr. Baca was a little bit premature, we then incorporated the September 18th order, which is the primary basis for this appeal. There was, and I see that my time is running short, so I just want to reiterate to the court that the primary reason that this appeal needs, or that the order needs to be vacated and at best be remanded back to the trial court for specific fact findings, findings that correlate to the statute on the September 18th order. We have no idea where this calculation of $91,000 came from. We have no idea. There was never any bill of costs. There was never any affidavits. There was nothing that even allowed Mr. Crone to file this. And furthermore, it's also in the briefs, and I just want to bring this to the court's attention if there are any questions regarding this, that both the initial complaint and the counterclaim were voluntarily withdrawn after the court improperly did not allow the amended complaint to go through and cure whatever supposed defects were in the initial complaint. The fact that they were voluntarily withdrawn means that under the CRS and also under CRC P 11, attorney's fees are improperly awarded, and they can't even be awarded under that.
You have about 7 minutes left.
So if there are no more questions, I will allow my colleagues.
Let me just ask you one question, and I know I want to save time. I understand your argument that the numbers, you had affidavits for this much dollars, but not that there, Mr. Crone added a bunch, some amount after the fact he didn't get to respond to it. I understand that. I'm not understanding your argument about what findings the court didn't make just on the merits. The court found that the filing here was frivolous and groundless because this product was never operational. There was no fraud lawsuit as alleged. I guess I'm not understanding, what more did the court have to find? The court said there was no factual basis for this complaint that your client filed.
The court did not go down and through Section A through H actually find with specificity all of the factors that were involved in 13.
What law says the court has to find every factor? And in fact, isn't there a law that says exactly the opposite?
No, and that's where I would disagree with that. And I would submit to the court that because there is the comment that says among others, that's not saying in the language of the statute itself, that's not saying that the court is free to disagree with or the court is free to simply disregard some of those factors. It's saying that the court has to find all of those factors sufficient for an appeal, and then they can find additional factors. So the fact that it says that it has to find all of those factors, comma, among others, that language offsets. So thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matthew Buck. I represent the appellants Ashley Buss and the Rasser Shop. The issue I'd like to focus on from my brief is the impermissive joinder of Ashley Buss to this lawsuit, which originally filed as plaintiff, the Raster Shop. Counsel for the appellee points to the fact that they believe that this was joinder and not piercing the corporate veil because defendant appellee Clifton Crone could not receive complete relief unless Ashley Buss was joined to the case. I believe that case law still requires that in order to pierce the corporate veil, that the three-part test from In re Phillips must be met. And that was not done here. Effectively, the district court sua sponte joined Buss to the Raster lawsuit without going through any of the factor tests, without admitting any evidence whatsoever.
Well, Mr. Buck, do you agree that there was a motion filed to join Mr. Buss and that the court granted that motion?
Well, I agree that the motion was filed and it was granted, but the court granted that motion in error because whether the court granted the motion or not, it was still a defective motion as filed. It contained no evidence that complete relief could not be had against the Raster Shop, A, and B. It did not address the three-factor test whatsoever, which is still required in order to pierce the corporate veil. The interaction that Crone initially had was not with Ashley Buss, the individual, it was with Ashley Buss, agent of the Raster Shop. And as the test requires, was Buss the alter ego of Raster? No. Raster had employees. They had other employees that Crone had dealings with, multiple employees. This was not just a small shop. I mean, it was small as far as software development goes, but as far as employees go, there were multiple people and workers on this project that Crone had contact with throughout the entire course of their dealings. The second part of the test was Raster used to perpetrate a fraud? No, they weren't. They were engaging in business dealings that were the normal course of business for the Raster Shop at that time. Everything was above board. This was not some attempt to bilk money from Crone or any sort of other fraud this court could imagine. And the final part of the three-part test is, and this is what I was saying about getting complete relief, is could an equitable result be achieved by not joining that party? And I would submit that yes, that because Crone had no dealings with Buss as Buss the individual, complete relief could be obtained from Raster. And none of this was addressed in the motion whatsoever. It basically was a late filed, effectively it was as if Buss was an intervening party, although he was not, he was there the whole time. They could have made a motion for joinder immediately, but they didn't, and there was some tumult with both parties changing counsel, and that may have something to do with it. But even though it was late filed, it was still defective. It could have been filed immediately, and the motion as filed would have been defective because it didn't address any of the reasons why Buss needed to be joined.
So, Mr. Buck, go ahead, Judge.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just got a factual question for you. Was there ever a counterclaim filed against Mr. Buss? I have a counterclaim that was filed here by the defendants, and Mr. Buss's name is not on there, and there doesn't appear to be a claim. I looked. I didn't necessarily see a counterclaim or any kind of claim against Mr. Buss. You know, there's a joinder in the air, but I'm not sure I see a claim.
There was not a claim specifically addressed to Mr. Buss,
okay,
Your Honor. I believe that the court operated, I believe, improperly in treating Buss as if he was Raster Shop, and this was just his DBA. It was not. Their employees, I've been to their shop, I met people that work there that were not Ashley Buss. This was not a one-man operation. There were multiple people working there when I was there. And
so, Mr. Bug, is it your position that the court could not grant a Rule 19 joinder motion without going through an analysis for piercing the corporate veil?
That would be my argument, Your Honor, especially given the fact that the facts of this case would have led anyone that looked into the actual facts to realize that Buss and Raster were not the same person. And even if this court were to throw away the piercing the corporate veil argument, the complete relief argument is so similar to the piercing the corporate veil argument in what do you need to get complete relief. I think that in the sense of a DBA where the LLC corporation has no pockets whatsoever and the deep pockets are truly the alter ego, that may make sense, but this wasn't that case. The whole purpose of the limited liability corporation is to allow someone to do business without having their personal assets seized for business matters which they're undergoing under the normal course of business.
Right, I understand that, but if there are specific allegations against the a member of a corporation, isn't it possible to join that person in addition to suing the corporate entity?
I think it is possible, Your Honor. However, I would say that the protections afforded to individuals are still present, that there's no sort of way to join a party to something without any sort of defenses to them. And that's the whole purpose of the Rule 19, is to allow how you're going to get complete relief. That was not even asserted. Even if we're going to say, and I'm not willing to concede that, my time has run off.
No, go ahead. Okay. Finish your
story. So my point would be that the Rule 19 protections of a requirement to display why you need to join a party in order to obtain complete relief are similar to the test of piercing the corporate veil. You need to show why the individual must be joined, and part of that is how they were operating independent of the LLC. It was not shown here. The motion in its face was defective. It contained no evidence or legal argument. It was simply a request for joinder without any sort of legal basis.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Buck.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Annette Powell-Myrick. I'm here on behalf of the appellees Clifton Crone and Anagami Systems. Their registration number is 34817. This case is solely about an award of sanctions that was entered against the plaintiffs and their counsel, Mr. Baca, for attorney fees and expert fees and costs. The record here is long. I know you guys have all read it. And there's multiple citations to the record in our brief. But what this comes down to is that the record itself supports the court's conclusion that the case itself was filed in bad faith. And it also supports the conclusion that there was not an abuse of discretion by Judge Hyatt when he actually rendered the award on June 25th.
Ms. Palmark, I'm going to jump in right here because time is so limited. Could you help me understand how Mr. Buss got joined? What's the basis for the joinder? Was there any claim against him? I mean, I have your motion in front of me, the motion on yours, I don't think. I see there's an allegation he made misrepresentations. There's an allegation there's no written contract. There was never any claim against him. So I'm going to stop talking here in a second, but I'll tell you what my concern is. It feels to me like he got joined for the sole purposes of then saying he's a plaintiff, award fees against him. And I'm having trouble understanding how that would be proper. He didn't bring this case. He was not a plaintiff. In other words, he wasn't the plaintiff when what you say is a frivolous action got brought. He joined it. It kind of joined him after the fact and then tag him with a frivolous complaint. That's troubling to me.
Okay.
So I'll shut up now and listen to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. The first thing that I want to point out is that the motion for joinder appears in the record at page 157 to 159, and the counterclaim does not appear in the record until just after that. So they were filed at the same time. So there wasn't an opportunity for the court to rule on the motion for joinder prior to the time the counterclaim was filed. But the counterclaim itself, at paragraph 11, 12, 13, 14, asserts on multiple occasions that Raster and Mr. Buss never created a functional software application, that Raster and Mr. Buss breached the agreement. And it goes on, and you'll find that throughout the counterclaim. So I think it's important to note that they were making allegations against Mr. Buss, but he hadn't quite been joined yet because the motion for joinder hadn't yet been ruled on.
And there was no amended counterclaim ever filed, right?
That's correct. So, excuse me, and the joinder was pursuant to Rules 13 and 19. And despite what my opposing counsel states, there's nothing in Rules 13 or 19 or even in the annotations that sets forth there has to also be a corresponding motion to pierce the corporate veil in order to add a party in order to add a party to file a claim or counterclaim against them. So I wanted to point out that the motion for joinder asserted that Buss should be joined because his complaint itself expressed his personal interest in the matter. And also because of the lack of executed agreement between the parties, that there's a question as to whether there is personal liability on both of them. And you'll see that throughout the motion. It also discussed the fact that Buss could incur damages personally for the misstatements that he made, both to the court and as well as to his attorney that were later represented in his complaint. So the defendant certainly did set forth that there were enumerated factors that were proper pursuant to Rule 19.
Well, let's walk through those elements. Tell me why that complete relief couldn't be accorded among the parties if Mr. Buss wasn't joined. Tell me where there was a substantial risk of double, multiple, or inconsistent obligations if there was a judgment against Mr. Buss's company but not him.
Well, I believe one of the substantial factors in that is the fact that there was never a signed agreement between the parties, and that appears in the record as well. I don't have a specific
citation. Did anybody ever deny there was an agreement?
I'm sorry?
Did the plaintiff here ever deny there was an agreement? Weren't they suing on the very agreement?
They were suing on the very agreement, and Mr. Krohn appeared as a party personally as well. And part of this also comes down to, and you'll find this in the transcript itself, and I can give you a citation to it if you'd like to. One of the things that the defendant's attorney said at the time was that the allegation of fraud that was against the defendants was related to something to do with some GoDaddy accounts, and that they hadn't had an opportunity to do additional discovery on that, but that the GoDaddy accounts may have been in the name of Ashley Buss as opposed to Raster. So that was yet another reason why they felt that there couldn't be complete relief on the even in the defense part of the counterclaim for fraud, or of the original claim for fraud, because the claim for fraud was based on those GoDaddy accounts.
Okay.
Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
I think so. Sorry.
Okay, that's okay. The other thing that I wanted to respond to, Your Honors, is the affidavits. The affidavits that are in file with the court, I know the court has looked at them. The total amount that is seen in those affidavits, it's not $25,000. The total amounts in that affidavit come to $90,480.86. And I do have citations to the record in my brief. I can pull those up if you'd like me to. So
just for clarity, we're talking about Ms. Halloran's affidavit and Mr. Walker's affidavits?
That's correct. Okay. Three different days that those were filed.
Okay, and they come to 90, is that fees and costs?
Yes, okay. Attorney's fees, expert fees, and costs. So even if the June 25th order were based on those, as my opposing counsel alleges, it was still a total amount of $90,480.86, not $25,000. So the court's subsequent order of September 18th was not incorrect. Now, there is a slight difference. I think the difference was around $700 and some dollars, and I noted that in my brief. That was related to the fact that when Mr. Krohn did file his motion for entry of judgment, that he had put that number in there, and it was a little bit different. I don't have any thing in the record that tells you why it would be different, but what it comes down to is the affidavits of attorney fees certainly show more than $25,000. I wanted to also...
I'm sorry, before you go on, can I ask you just a factual question?
Yes, please.
Was Mr. Krohn's motion for entry of judgment ever served on the other side? They say not. Do you know?
They say not, but the information does not actually appear in the record.
Any kind of certificate of service in the record?
There is not a certificate of service in the record, but the record also does not reflect whether the court used the ISIS system or Lexis, whichever it was at the time, to actually serve the opposing counsels. That part of the record was not given from the court.
Thank you.
There was a question about voluntary withdrawal of the complaint, and I disagree that voluntarily withdrawing the complaint, especially at the time that it was withdrawn, affords any relief to the parties. I think this is important for a couple of reasons. First of all, voluntary withdrawal of the complaint was never raised in the prior court. There was never a response to the motion for award of attorney fees. In addition, there was a hearing held over a period of 2 days, and neither party ever mentioned anything about the fact they shouldn't be subject to these attorney fees because there was a voluntary withdrawal of the complaint. But moving on from that, if you look at paragraph 5, page 3 of the court's June 25th order, the court specifically states that Mr. Buss knew that a truly functional product did not exist at the time he engaged Mr. Baca as his attorney to file the lawsuit. Mr. Buss also knew at the time he engaged Mr. Baca there was no interstate lawsuit alleging fraud against him. So 1317.1025 does not apply. because it's not a matter of researching whether these things happen. These things didn't happen, and Mr. Buss said they did, and that's why they were included in the complaint. The court moved on to state at paragraph 7, page 3 of the court order, that there were no facts, argument, or law that supported the filing of this action, and Mr. Baca made no effort to ascertain this. The case was brought before the court without a substantial basis. Therefore, any factors under 1317.1025 simply don't apply. I also wanted to touch on joinder. We already talked about joinder, correct?
I've got a quick question about joint and several liability. As I understand it, Mr. Baca was held jointly and severally liable for some of the fees that occurred after he was effectively removed from the case and replaced by different counsel. And so I'm wondering how that works in combination with 1317.102 that refers to joint and several liability among the offending attorneys and parties. I guess I'm wondering how he can be an offending attorney and party, not to the part of the case where he was actually acting as the attorney, but as to the part of the case where another attorney was making the decisions and deciding what would be filed, et cetera.
At the point that Mr. Baca withdrew, the matter had already commenced through several proceedings, several hearings, and several motions. So at that point, there was already several thousand dollars in attorney fees that had been incurred. And you can actually see that when there was an objection to the substitution of counsel. And the objection appears to at case file page 211. And opposing side had already stated that all these fees had already been incurred. And at the same time, this actually was the objection to the motion to amend. They're together. And what you'll see is that the case had already proceeded so far. There had been case management orders. There had been discovery that had already been done. Experts had already been hired and their expert reports filed with the court. So the case had already proceeded for approximately 7 to 8 months by the time Mr. Baca was attempting to substitute counsel. So the substance of the case had already gone that far. And he was not relieved of liability because he simply had himself substituted on something that on the work that he had already done. The court found that it was his fault that that it had gone this far because he didn't research the items.
I'm not so concerned with the work that occurred up to the point that he withdrew, or perhaps some work after that could be reasonably attributed to the work that he had done previously. I guess I'm just concerned if there are some sort of fees that were incurred in the defense of actions that the new attorney had done. For example, the attempt at the interlock. The attempt to file an interlocutory appeal.
Okay, so you're concerned that whether he was charged for the interlocutory appeal motion?
Well, work like that came after the point that he basically was replaced.
Okay, my response to that, Your Honor, would simply be that the work that took place afterwards was all in conjunction with all the work that had already taken place to start off with, and it all related back to the original complaint. And he had been on notice from the court on multiple occasions that there was no substantiation for the suit, and gave him an opportunity to actually dismiss the case or test his claims. And that actually is found in the record. Judge Havas, at the hearing on March 16th, 2012, said, I am allowing the defense to preserve, the plaintiff was given 90 days to conduct limited discovery in order to test the sufficiency of the allegations sooner rather than later. Discovery was never conducted, and it would be our position, Your Honor, that discovery wasn't conducted, the case was not dismissed or withdrawn, and continued on, and the defense had to continue incurring these fees that they should never have had to have been incurred in the first place. The last thing I'd like to touch base on is there's an argument regarding 1317.103.1 about factors that need to be considered when rendering an order. Parker v. Davis, we cited this in our brief, 888 P. 2nd, 324, page 326, states the failure of the court to address each and every factor in its order does not render the order deficient. In addition, and I think this is even more important, the Parker Court specifically held at the bottom of page 326, it's the last sentence, I believe, that the trial court is under no obligation to issue specific findings when none of the factors in this section are placed at issue. And I just remind the court that There was never a response to either one of the motions to dismiss and the motions for sanctions, and in any objections to the arrival of attorney fees or the amount of attorney fees or whether the sanctions were appropriate was not brought up even in the hearings by either Mr. Baca or by Mr. Buss's new counsel at the time.
So let me ask you about that, because the opposing counsel was saying that when Mr. Crone filed his motion for entry of judgment regarding the amount of attorney's fees, that they were suggesting that there was no opportunity to object to that amount. What is your response to that?
Okay, Your Honor, I understand the question, and I disagree with that position. There was multiple occasions along the way. Affidavits were filed along the way. Two motions for sanctions were filed along the way. What happened when Mr. Crone filed his motion for entry of judgment, and it was not a domestic relations form, it doesn't say anything about domestic relations on it. It simply says, we need a number based upon the order, is essentially what that says in the very first sentence. And he was simply asking the court to render an order that he could attempt to collect the judgment with.
But did Mr. Baca and Rastershop have an opportunity to object to the amount that was in that motion for entry of judgment?
Yes, they did, and that was when the original motions to dismiss and motions for sanctions were made. There was never responses to those, and that's what those hearings were made up of as well. And the affidavits on file are undeniable, Your Honor. There was an opportunity to respond to those, and no one responded to them. And I guess the question becomes, why wasn't there a response to those?
So let me ask, I know your time's almost up. I know you say the numbers basically matched up. You know, maybe it was a $700 difference. Hypothetically, if the numbers didn't match up, say they were right, and just assume this, I know you disagree, that Mr. Crone added $25,000 or whatever it was. If those were the facts, there would be an issue, would there not? I mean, they would not have had a chance to respond to that extra 25 if those were the facts, true?
I would agree with that, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, your time is up.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. May I just quickly conclude?
In one sentence, you may.
We very simply ask the court to affirm the court below, Your Honor, the order below, Your Honor.
And thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all, counsel. We appreciate your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. After counsel has had it.